A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
I was reading this paper from the Journal of Neurogastroenterology and Motility last week, and I realize how that sounds, but stick with me, and it completely reframed how I think about reflux. It's not just about what's in the tube, it's about who's driving the tube.
Daniel sent us one that gets into exactly this. He's been dealing with post-gallbladder surgery issues for 7 years now. Bloating, bile reflux, the whole miserable package, and he's been digging into motility as a different lens on the problem. His question, stripped down, is, what does motility actually mean when body fluids start moving in the wrong direction? Why does the peristaltic machinery that's supposed to push things downstream sometimes fail, or even reverse? And what other treatment approaches, both traditional and emerging?
Before we dive in, quick note. Today's script is coming to us from DeepSeek V4 Pro, so if anything sounds unusually coherent, that's why.
Or if it doesn't, that's on us.
Let's start with what the word actually means, because I think most people hear motility and think colon, slow transit, constipation, the stuff you see yogurt commercials about. But gastrointestinal motility is the coordinated muscular activity of the entire digestive tract, from the moment you swallow to the endpoint. It's a symphony of contraction and relaxation patterns, and when it works, you never think about it. When it breaks in ways that are surprisingly specific to which part of the orchestra went rogue.
Daniel's situation is interesting because he's not asking about the colon. He's asking about the upper GI tract, the stomach, the esophagus, and this weird bidirectional problem where bile that should be heading south ends up north in places it absolutely should not be.
So let's build this from the ground up. You've got esophageal peristalsis, the wave of contraction that pushes food down after you swallow. Primary peristalsis is triggered by the swallow itself. Secondary peristalsis kicks in if refluxate comes up and the esophagus needs to clear it back down. Then you've got the lower esophageal sphincter, the LES, a ring of muscle at the junction between esophagus and stomach that stays closed except when you swallow, belch, or vomit. Below that, gastric accommodation. The stomach's ability to relax and expand to receive food without a pressure spike. Then antral contractions in the lower stomach that grind food and push it into the duodenum in a controlled way, with the pyloric sphincter regulating outflow. And critically, for Daniel's specific problem, you've got duodenal motility and the migrating motor complex, a housekeeping wave that sweeps through the small intestine between meals and clears out debris, including bile.
That's a lot of moving parts. And Daniel's point is that for years, doctors have focused on the chemistry, the acid, the bile, the inflammation, and not enough on the mechanics. The stuff is there, yes, but why is it moving the wrong direction?
This is where the gallbladder removal piece becomes mechanically fascinating. Normally, your liver produces bile continuously. Between meals, that bile gets diverted into the gallbladder, where it's concentrated and stored. When you eat a fatty meal, the gallbladder contracts and squirts concentrated bile into the duodenum in a nice timed pulse coordinated with the arrival of food. After cholecystectomy, that whole timing mechanism is gone. The liver just drips bile into the duodenum continuously, including between meals when there's no food to dilute or buffer it. You've lost the reservoir and the timed release.
You've got this constant trickle of bile pooling in the duodenum during fasting periods. And then what?
Then, two things can happen, and they're both motility problems. First, if duodenal motility is sluggish, if those migrating motor complex waves aren't firing properly to sweep the bile downstream, it just sits there, pooling, and the concentration of bile acids builds up. Second, and this is the real kicker, you can get duodenogastric reflux. That's where duodenal contents, including bile, flow backward into the stomach. Normally, the pylorus prevents this, but pyloric function can be impaired, and disordered antroduodenal motility can create pressure gradients that push duodenal contents retrograde.
The bile isn't just passively drifting upward. There's actual reverse peristalsis happening.
It can be, There are manometry studies, where they put a pressure-sensing catheter through your nose, down into your stomach, and duodenum, that show retrograde propagation of duodenal contractions in patients with bile reflux. Instead of the wave pushing toward the jejunum, it pushes back toward the stomach. The motility pattern is literally running in reverse.
That's wild. Your gut has a gear shift, and it's stuck in reverse.
It gets worse. Once bile is in the stomach, if the lower esophageal sphincter is weak, or if there are transient LES relaxations, spontaneous relaxations not triggered by swallowing, the bile can reflux up into the esophagus. Bile is particularly nasty there. It's alkaline, not acidic, so proton pump inhibitors don't touch it. And it's been implicated in Barrett's esophagus and esophageal adenocarcinoma. A paper in Annals of Surgery found that bile reflux is an independent risk factor for Barrett's, separate from acid reflux.
Let me trace the whole chain. Daniel had his gallbladder out. Now bile drips continuously instead of being stored in pulsed. If his duodenal motility is sluggish, the bile pools. If his intraduodenal coordination is off, retrograde contractions push that bile back into his stomach. And if his LES isn't holding tight, the bile goes up into his esophagus and causes damage that acid-suppressing drugs won't fix. That's the mechanical cascade.
That's exactly the chain. And Daniel mentioned that things like caffeine and alcohol seem to drive his reflux, and he wasn't sure if it was production or motility. The answer is both, but motility is the part most people miss. Caffeine relaxes the lower esophageal sphincter. That's well established. It also stimulates gastric acid secretion, but the LES relaxation is arguably the bigger problem for reflux. Alcohol does the same thing. LES pressure drops measurably after consumption. Both can also affect duodenal motility patterns.
When someone says coffee gives me heartburn, the popular understanding is that it's making their stomach produce more acid. But the motility angle suggests it might be more about loosening the gate that keeps stuff down.
And that's an important reframe because it shifts treatment thinking. If your problem is primarily mechanical, weak sphincters, disordered motility, acid suppression alone is never going to fully solve it. You need to address the motility itself.
Which brings us to treatment. What's out there?
Let me organize this into categories. Traditional first, then emerging. On the traditional side, you've got prokinetic agents, drugs that enhance GI motility. The classic ones are metoclopramide, or Reglan, and domperidone, which isn't FDA approved in the US but is used in Canada and Europe. They work by blocking dopamine receptors in the gut, which increases the strength of esophageal and gastric contractions and tightens the LES. The problem is side effects. Metoclopramide crosses the blood-brain barrier and can cause tardive dyskinesia, a potentially irreversible movement disorder. The FDA put a black box warning on it. Domperidone doesn't cross as much, so neurological side effects are lower, but it can prolong the QT interval, which is a cardiac arrhythmia risk.
The drugs that make things move also carry real risk.
Then you've got erythromycin, an antibiotic that happens to be a motilin receptor agonist. Motilin triggers the migrating motor complex. Low-dose erythromycin can stimulate gastric emptying and duodenal motility, used off-label for gastroparesis. But you can't use it long-term because it's an antibiotic and you'll develop resistance and mess up your microbiome.
What about prucalopride?
Prucalopride is a selective serotonin receptor agonist, specifically 5-HT4, approved for chronic constipation. It accelerates colonic transit. But there's been interest in using it for upper GI motility disorders too, because 5-HT4 receptors are present throughout the gut. Studies show it can improve gastric emptying and reduce reflux episodes in some patients, with a cleaner side effect profile than the older prokinetics.
That's traditional and neo-traditional. What's on the emerging side?
This is where it gets genuinely exciting. One approach is gastric electrical stimulation, a surgically implanted device like a pacemaker for the stomach that delivers low-energy electrical pulses to the stomach wall. It's been used primarily for gastroparesis, but there's emerging evidence it can improve symptoms in functional dyspepsia and possibly bile reflux by normalizing intraduodenal coordination. The mechanism isn't fully understood. It doesn't necessarily accelerate gastric emptying in everyone, but it seems to modulate visceral sensitivity and reset disordered electrical rhythms in the stomach.
A pacemaker for your gut. How common is that?
It's been around since the early 2000s, but it's still specialized, maybe a few thousand implants worldwide. The primary device is made by Entera, FDA approved under a humanitarian device exemption for refractory gastroparesis. Using it for post-cholecystectomy bile reflux would be off-label, but there are case reports. Pyloric interventions are getting a lot of attention. If the pylorus is too tight, pyloroplasm, it can cause gastroparesis and potentially contribute to reflux by creating back pressure. There's a procedure called GPOEM, gastric peroral endoscopic myotomy. They go in endoscopically and cut the pyloric muscle to relax it. The literature is growing and showing decent results for refractory gastroparesis. Whether it helps bile reflux specifically is less clear. But if impaired gastric emptying is leading to retrograde flow, relaxing the outlet could theoretically help.
You're either pacing the stomach electrically or cutting the pylorus to let things drain better. Both are pretty invasive.
But there's a less invasive angle too, and it connects to something Daniel mentioned about bile and inflammation. There's a class of drugs called bile acid sequestrants. The classic one is cholestyramine, a powder you mix with water and drink. It binds bile acids in the intestine so they can't be reabsorbed or cause damage. It's been used for bile acid diarrhea for decades, but it's also used off-label for bile reflux, because if you bind the bile, it can't reflux and cause damage even if the motility problem persists. The downside is it's gritty, tastes terrible, and can interfere with absorption of fat-soluble vitamins.
It's a workaround rather than a fix. You're not solving the motility problem, you're just neutralizing the bile, so it can't hurt you when it goes where it shouldn't.
And that's an important distinction in digestive medicine. Are you treating the cause or treating the consequence? A lot of reflux treatment is consequence management.
Let me pull on that thread. Daniel's been dealing with this for 7 years. He's probably been offered PPIs, maybe bile acid sequestrants, dietary modifications, but he's still searching. What does the cutting edge look like for someone who's exhausted the standard options?
A few directions. One is neurostimulation beyond the gastric pacemaker. There's transcutaneous auricular vagus nerve stimulation, TVNS, where you stimulate a branch of the vagus nerve through the skin of the outer ear. The vagus nerve is the main parasympathetic highway to the gut, controlling gastric accommodation, antral contractions, pyloric tone. The idea is that by modulating vagal tone non-invasively, you might improve motility patterns. It's been studied for functional dyspepsia and gastroparesis with mixed but promising results. The device is basically a little electrode you clip to your ear for a few minutes a day.
That sounds like something from a biohacking forum.
It kind of is. But it's being studied in legitimate academic centers, University of Michigan, Harvard. It's not mainstream yet, but the mechanism is plausible and the safety profile is excellent.
What about the microbiome angle? I've seen papers suggesting gut bacteria influence motility.
Huge and underappreciated. The gut microbiome produces metabolites, short-chain fatty acids, secondary bile acids, neurotransmitters like serotonin and GABA that directly affect the enteric nervous system. The enteric nervous system is a mesh of neurons embedded in the gut wall, sometimes called the second brain. It contains something like 500 million neurons and can operate independently of the central nervous system, controlling peristalsis, blood flow, secretion. Gut microbes talk to it constantly.
If your microbiome is disrupted, say from antibiotics, or from the altered bile flow after gallbladder removal, that can mess with the neural circuitry that controls motility.
That's the hypothesis. There's a specific condition called small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, SIBO, that's been associated with altered motility. If your migrating motor complex isn't sweeping effectively, bacteria that should stay in the colon migrate up into the small intestine, where they ferment carbohydrates and produce gas, bloating, and further motility disruption. It becomes a vicious cycle, and there's some evidence that post-cholecystectomy patients have higher rates of SIBO, possibly because the continuous bile drip alters the antimicrobial environment of the small intestine.
Bile has antimicrobial properties.
Yeah, bile acids are detergent-like molecules that disrupt bacterial membranes. They're part of the gut's innate defense system. If the bile delivery pattern changes, continuous trickle instead of concentrated pulses, that might change which bacteria can thrive where. It's speculative, but biologically plausible.
Daniel's bloating might not just be bile pooling. It might be bacterial fermentation driven by motility-driven SIBO.
Could be both, and this is the frustration of functional GI disorders. They're rarely one thing. You've got altered anatomy from the cholecystectomy, altered bile flow dynamics, probably some degree of visceral hypersensitivity where the nerves overreact to normal stimuli, maybe some SIBO, maybe some low-grade duodenal inflammation from constant bile exposure. All of these interact.
Let me ask the question Daniel is probably asking himself. What can he actually do? If he walks into a motility specialist's office, what's the diagnostic path and treatment algorithm?
The diagnostic workup for suspected upper GI motility disorder would typically start with a gastric emptying study. You eat a meal tagged with a radioisotope, usually eggs with technetium-99m, and they scan you over 4 hours to see how fast the stomach empties. That tells you if there's gastroparesis. Then you might do esophageal manometry to assess peristalsis and LES function. If bile reflux is suspected, you can do an impedance pH study, which has sensors that detect both acid and non-acid reflux, crucial because bile is alkaline and won't show up on a standard pH probe. You can also do a Biletech probe, which uses spectrophotometry to specifically detect bilirubin, a marker for bile.
You can actually measure bile in the esophagus directly.
You can, though Biletech isn't available everywhere. More commonly, they use the impedance channels on the pH impedance catheter to detect liquid reflux regardless of pH. If they see non-acid reflux episodes correlating with symptoms, that's strongly suggestive of bile reflux.
Once you've got that data, what's the stepwise treatment?
First line is usually lifestyle and dietary. Smaller meals because gastric distension triggers transient LES relaxations. Low fat because fat delays gastric emptying and stimulates bile release. Avoid eating within 3 hours of bedtime. Elevate the head of the bed. Avoid trigger foods, caffeine, alcohol, chocolate, mint, all of which reduce LES pressure.
The classic reflux advice, but the mechanism is motility-based, not acid-based.
Second line is pharmacological. If there's evidence of gastroparesis or slowed motility, you try a prokinetic, understanding the side effect risks. If bile is the primary problem, you try a bile acid sequestrant like cholestyramine or cholecystavelin. Some clinicians will try sucralfate, a coating agent that binds to damaged mucosa and might also bind some bile acids. If there's a SIBO component, you treat with rifaximin or other antibiotics.
If all that fails,
then you're into the interventional options. If the pylorus is tight, GPOEM. If there's global dysmotility, gastric electrical stimulation. If there's a hiatal hernia contributing to LES incompetence, surgical fundoplication, though that's tricky in bile reflux because fundoplication stops acid reflux but doesn't necessarily stop bile reflux, and some studies suggest the wrap can actually trap bile in the stomach.
That's a nightmare scenario. You do surgery to fix reflux and end up making the bile problem worse.
This is why motility testing before anti-reflux surgery is so important. If you've got significant duodenogastric reflux on manometry, a fundoplication might be contraindicated. Some surgeons will do a Roux-en-Y reconstruction instead, which diverts bile away from the stomach entirely. That's a big surgery, but for severe refractory bile reflux, it's sometimes the only thing that works. A series from the Cleveland Clinic showed significant symptom improvement in something like 80% of patients.
The treatment ladder goes from lifestyle to pills to endoscopic procedures to electrical implants to full surgical rerouting. That's quite a range.
Most patients never need to go past the first two rungs. Daniel's been struggling for 7 years, so he may be further along, but the key is getting the right diagnostics to understand exactly which motility problem he has. The treatment for impaired gastric emptying is different from the treatment for pyloraspasm, which is different from the treatment for duodenal dysmotility with retrograde contractions. You can't just throw prokinetics at it and hope.
This connects to something I've been thinking about. When Daniel describes his experience, he talks about feeling like his digestive tract just doesn't work as well as it did. And I think a lot of people with functional GI disorders have that subjective sense. Something is off, the machinery isn't running right. But they can't point to a structural problem because there isn't one. The endoscopy is clean, the CT scan is normal, the labs are fine, and the medical system is terrible at dealing with problems that don't show up on imaging.
That's the functional GI disorder paradox. The symptoms are real, the suffering is real, but the pathology is in the software, not the hardware. It's in the neural control systems, the coordination patterns, the timing. And until recently, we didn't have good tools to assess that. Manometry and impedance testing have changed things, but they're still underutilized. A lot of gastroenterologists will do an endoscopy, see no erosions or ulcers, and tell the patient they're fine.
The patient is not fine. They're just not damaged in a way that's visible on a camera.
Functional does not mean imaginary. It means the function is disordered, not the structure. And motility is the core function, the movement, the timing, the coordination. Daniel's instinct to focus on motility is exactly right. He's looking at the software when everyone else has been looking at the hardware.
Let's talk about the esophageal side specifically. He mentioned esophageal motility problems. What does that look like when it goes wrong?
There's a spectrum. On the mild end, ineffective esophageal motility. The peristaltic waves are weak or fragmentary. The esophagus still tries to push things down, but it's not generating enough force. This is common in GERD patients and contributes to poor acid clearance. On the severe end, achalasia, where the LES fails to relax and the esophageal body loses peristalsis entirely. Food and liquid just accumulate until the pressure overcomes the LES. Between those, you've got distal esophageal spasm and hypercontractile esophagus.
These are diagnosed by manometry?
High-resolution manometry specifically. It's a catheter with 36 pressure sensors spaced a centimeter apart, generating a beautiful color topographic plot of pressure along the entire esophagus during swallows. It's one of the most informative tests in gastroenterology when interpreted well. The Chicago classification system categorizes motility disorders based on these pressure patterns.
Is any of this connected to the bile reflux issue, or is esophageal dysmotility a separate problem?
They can be connected in both directions. Chronic reflux, including bile reflux, can cause esophageal inflammation that damages the neuromuscular apparatus and leads to dysmotility. And primary esophageal dysmotility can impair clearance of refluxate, making the damage worse. There's also evidence that bile acids are directly toxic to esophageal smooth muscle and enteric neurons. So the bile isn't just causing mucosal damage. It might be poisoning the motility machinery itself.
That's grim. The stuff that's supposed to help you digest fat is dissolving the nerves that control your swallowing.
The body is a delicate balance, and when you remove the gallbladder, which is often necessary and the right decision for symptomatic gallstones, you're altering a system that evolved over millions of years. The gallbladder isn't a vestigial organ. It's a sophisticated storage and timing device. When you take it out, you're trading one set of problems for another, and for most people, the trade is worth it. But for the subset who develop post-cholecystectomy syndrome with significant bile reflux, it can be a really difficult road.
Let me circle back to something Daniel said about inflammation. He mentioned that emerging research suggests continuous bile drip into the intestine might be a driver of inflammation. What's the mechanism there?
Bile acids are signaling molecules as well as detergents. They activate receptors like FXR and TGR5 that regulate metabolism, immune function, and gut barrier integrity. When bile acids are delivered in the normal pulsatile pattern, these signaling pathways are activated in a controlled way. When there's a continuous drip, or when bile acids pool in the duodenum and reach higher concentrations, you get aberrant signaling. TGR5 activation on immune cells can promote inflammation. Bile acids at high concentrations can disrupt tight junction proteins in the intestinal epithelium, increasing gut permeability, the so-called leaky gut, that allows bacterial products to cross into the circulation and trigger systemic inflammation.
The motility problem creates a bile pooling problem, which creates an inflammation problem, which might then feed back and worsen the motility problem.
That's the model. And it's supported by animal studies showing that duodenal infusion of bile acids triggers duodenal inflammation and impairs antroduodenal motility. Jantak's lab at KU Leuven has done a lot of work on this. They've shown that duodenal infusion of bile acids induces gastric dysrhythmias and nausea in healthy volunteers.
Gastric dysrhythmias? That's like an arrhythmia, but in the stomach's electrical pacemaker?
The stomach has its own pacemaker cells, the interstitial cells of Cajal, that generate a slow-wave electrical rhythm at about 3 cycles per minute. That rhythm coordinates antral contractions. Bile acids in the duodenum can disrupt that rhythm, leading to uncoordinated contractions and impaired gastric emptying, It's a direct link between bile and motility dysfunction.
Daniel's problem might literally be that bile is short-circuiting his stomach's electrical system.
That's a plausible piece of the puzzle. Not the whole story. These things are always multifactorial, but it's a mechanism demonstrated in controlled experimental settings.
What about the role of the vagus nerve in all this? You mentioned vagus nerve stimulation earlier. How central is the vagus to motility?
The vagus is the main conduit between the brain and the gut. It carries parasympathetic signals that promote digestion, increased gastric accommodation, increased antral contractions, coordinated pyloric relaxation. After gallbladder surgery, there's some evidence that vagal function can be altered. The surgery itself can cause some vagal nerve injury, though usually minor. But there's also a theory that the altered sensory signaling from the duodenum, because of the continuous bile drip and possible low-grade inflammation, changes vagal afferent signaling back to the brainstem, which then alters vagal efferent signaling back to the gut. It's a disrupted brain-gut loop.
The problem isn't just in the gut. It's in the communication line between the gut and the brain.
This is the biopsychosocial model of functional GI disorders. It's not that the symptoms are psychological. It's that the neural circuits connecting the gut and the brain are dysregulated. And this is why treatments that target the brain can sometimes help gut symptoms. Tricyclic antidepressants at low doses are used for functional dyspepsia and IBS, not because the patient is depressed, but because these drugs modulate pain processing and may affect motility through their effects on neurotransmitter systems.
That's one of those things that's easy to misunderstand. A doctor prescribes an antidepressant for a gut problem, and the patient thinks the doctor is saying it's all in their head.
Right, and that's a failure of communication. The doctor should be saying, your gut and your brain share the same wiring. This medication modulates that wiring. It's a neurological intervention for a neurological problem that happens to manifest in the gut, but that conversation often doesn't happen.
Let's pull back and talk about where the research is heading. What's on the horizon for motility disorders?
A few things I'm watching. One is bioelectronic medicine more broadly. Beyond the vagus nerve stimulation we talked about, there are companies working on implantable devices that can sense and modulate gut electrical activity in real time, like a closed-loop system. Instead of just pacing the stomach at a fixed rate, the device would detect dysrhythmias and deliver stimulation to correct them.
That sounds like a gut defibrillator.
Another area is targeted microbiome modulation, not just probiotics, which have a poor track record in motility disorders, but more sophisticated approaches like defined microbial consortia, postbiotic metabolites, or even bacteriophage therapy to reshape the microbial community in ways that favor normal motility.
What about pharmacological development? Any new prokinetics in the pipeline?
There's been a drought, partly because of regulatory hurdles after the sisapride withdrawal in the late 90s. Sisapride was a great prokinetic, but it caused QT prolongation and sudden cardiac death in some patients. Since then, the bar for cardiac safety has been very high, but there are candidates. Velustreg, a 5-HT4 agonist like prucalopride but with a slightly different receptor profile, is being studied for gastroparesis. Relimorelin, a ghrelin agonist. Ghrelin is the hunger hormone, but it also stimulates gastric motility, showed promise in phase 2 trials for diabetic gastroparesis. There's tradipitant, a neurokinin 1 receptor antagonist being studied for gastroparesis-related nausea.
None of these are specifically for bile reflux, though.
No, and that's part of the problem. Bile reflux is an orphan condition in terms of drug development. It falls between the cracks, not quite GERD, not quite gastroparesis, not quite functional dyspepsia. The patient population is smaller, and the diagnostic criteria aren't standardized, so it's hard to run large clinical trials. Most of the evidence comes from small case series or extrapolation from related conditions.
Which must be frustrating for someone like Daniel, who's living it and looking for answers.
And I think that's why he's taken this deep dive into the physiology himself. When the medical system doesn't have a clear pathway, patients become their own researchers. Daniel's asking about motility because he's identified it as the missing piece in how his condition has been explained to him. And he's right.
Let me ask a practical question. If someone listening has post-cholecystectomy symptoms, bloating, bile reflux, that feeling of things not moving right, and they want to pursue the motility angle, what should they ask their gastroenterologist?
I'd say ask about motility testing specifically. Say, I'm concerned about duodenogastric reflux and impaired gastric emptying. Can we do a gastric emptying study and an impedance pH study to look for non-acid reflux? If those are abnormal, can we do antraduodenal manometry to look at coordination patterns? These are reasonable questions backed by guidelines. If the gastroenterologist dismisses them, consider a second opinion at an academic motility center. There are maybe 30 or 40 centers in the U.S. that have the full suite of motility diagnostics and the expertise to interpret them.
What about the dietary piece? Daniel mentioned caffeine and alcohol as triggers. Is there a motility-informed dietary approach beyond the standard avoid triggers advice?
There's some interesting work on meal composition and meal timing. The migrating motor complex only fires during fasting. If you're grazing constantly, eating small meals every 2 or 3 hours, you never allow the MMC to activate and sweep the duodenum clear of bile and debris. So there's an argument for longer fasting intervals between meals, maybe 4 or 5 hours, to let the housekeeping wave do its job. That's counter to the standard advice for GERD, which is small, frequent meals. But for bile reflux specifically, allowing the MMC to activate might be beneficial.
The advice could be exactly opposite, depending on whether the primary problem is acid reflux or bile reflux.
Which is why the diagnosis matters. If you treat bile reflux like acid reflux, you might make it worse. There's also a circadian rhythm to GI motility. Gastric emptying is slower at night, the MMC is less active, LES pressure drops during sleep. So nocturnal reflux is a bigger problem for a lot of patients, compounded if bile has been pooling in the duodenum all evening. Some motility specialists recommend a longer fasting window before bed, not just 3 hours, but 4 or 5, to ensure the stomach and duodenum are as empty as possible.
This is all making me think about how much of gastroenterology has been dominated by acid. For decades, the story was, acid is the enemy, suppress acid, problem solved. And proton pump inhibitors became one of the most prescribed drug classes in the world. But for patients like Daniel, acid isn't the problem. Bile is the problem, and motility is the mechanism.
The proton pump inhibitor era has been a mixed blessing. PPIs are incredibly effective for acid-related disease, erosive esophagitis, peptic ulcers, Zollinger, Ellison syndrome. But they've been massively overprescribed for symptoms that aren't acid-driven. And we're now learning about the long-term consequences of chronic acid suppression. Increased risk of enteric infections, nutrient malabsorption, possibly kidney disease, possibly dementia, though those associations are still debated. For someone with bile reflux, a PPI might provide some symptom relief by reducing the total volume of gastric secretion, but it's not addressing the core problem and it's exposing the patient to long-term risks.
The motility lens isn't just a better explanation. It might lead to better treatment decisions.
That's the hope. And I think it's where the field is moving, slowly. The Rome Foundation, which sets the diagnostic criteria for functional GI disorders, has been emphasizing motility and the brain-gut axis more and more with each iteration. Rome 4 came out in 2016 and really centered the concept of disorders of gut-brain interaction. Rome 5 is in development now and will probably go even further.
I want to touch on something Daniel mentioned in passing, the peristaltic motion in the colon. He noted that we have this peristaltic wave in the colon, but his focus was on the upper tract. Is there a connection between upper GI motility problems and colonic motility?
They can coexist. There's something called panenteric dysmotility, where the motility disorder affects the entire GI tract, seen in conditions like systemic sclerosis. But more commonly, the dysfunction is regional. However, there's crosstalk. Slow gastric emptying can alter the gastrocolic reflex, and severe constipation can increase intra-abdominal pressure and potentially worsen reflux, so they're not entirely independent.
For Daniel's situation, the focus should be upper GI.
His symptoms, bloating, bile reflux, are pointing to the stomach and duodenum primarily, and the esophagus secondarily.
Let me ask about one more thing. He mentioned that the bile makes its way up in the wrong direction. Is that purely passive, or is there an active retrograde propulsion?
Both can happen. Passive reflux occurs when there's a pressure gradient, supine position, increased intra-abdominal pressure from bloating or bending, and a weak or relaxed sphincter. Active retrograde propulsion is when the duodenum actually contracts in a retrograde direction. This has been documented on manometry. It's called a retrograde duodenal contraction, and it can propel duodenal contents back into the stomach against the normal gradient. It's not fully understood why this happens, but it may be related to disordered pacemaker activity in the duodenum or abnormal neural reflexes triggered by the presence of bile acids.
The gut can literally push things backward. That's counterintuitive for most people. We think of peristalsis as a one-way street.
It's supposed to be. But the gut has a complex neural network, and when signaling goes awry, the directionality can break down. It's like a highway where suddenly one lane starts moving in reverse. The infrastructure is fine, but the traffic control system has malfunctioned.
That's the core of Daniel's question. What does it mean when body fluids move in the wrong direction? It means the traffic control system, the enteric nervous system, the pacemaker cells, the vagal input, the hormonal signals, has lost coordination. The hardware is intact, but the software is buggy.
Fixing software is harder than fixing hardware. You can't just cut out the bad code. You have to debug the system, often through trial and error, using interventions that modulate the neural and chemical signals. That's why the treatment landscape is so fragmented and why patients like Daniel often have to try multiple approaches before finding something that helps.
Which brings us back to where we started. The motility lens reframes the problem from there's bile where it shouldn't be to the system that moves bile has lost its coordination. And that reframe opens up different treatment possibilities. Prokinetics, electrical stimulation, vagal modulation, timed fasting to engage the MMC, pyloric interventions, even surgical diversion in severe cases.
It validates the patient experience. When someone says, "My digestion just doesn't work right since the surgery," they're describing a motility problem in plain language. The medical system should be listening more carefully.
Herman, if you had to give Daniel one piece of actionable advice based on everything we've discussed, what would it be?
I'd say, find a motility specialist at an academic center and push for the full diagnostic workup. Gastric emptying study, impedance pH testing, and if indicated, antroduodenal manometry. The treatment follows the diagnosis, and without the right diagnosis, you're shooting in the dark. The specific tests I'd ask about are a 4-hour gastric emptying scan, a 24-hour impedance pH study off PPIs so you can see the non-acid reflux episodes, and possibly a Bilitec probe if they have it. If those show delayed emptying and significant bile reflux, then you can have a real conversation about prokinetics, bile acid sequestrants, or if those fail, the interventional options.
In the meantime, the practical stuff. Longer fasting intervals between meals, avoid eating within 4 hours of bed, elevate the head of the bed, minimize the trigger foods. Not because those are a cure, but because they reduce the mechanical load on a system that's struggling.
And keep pushing. 7 years is a long time to live with this, but the tools to understand it are getting better and the treatment options are expanding. It's not a hopeless situation by any means.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The collective noun for a group of porcupines is a prickle.
Remarkably on the nose.
Of course it is. And thank you to Hilbert Flumingtop, our producer, for that contribution. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. For Daniel and everyone else navigating the long road of figuring out what's wrong with their gut, keep asking the questions the system isn't answering. We'll be here.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.